Test, test. Hello, lovely people. We're going to have our first talk today. Our first proper talk. Woo! We had some difficulties, but we have a schedule now. The third one. And I want to walk you through the few things which are on here. So at 2, we have IPXD hacking with the M1 N1 iDevice in the sports hall. And all the workshops have been moved to the sports hall. So, yeah. And I want to give the stage to Domi, who will be talking about the internals of HTTP LTSH.
Thank you. Disclaimer right off the bat, the presentation is like 5/8 finished due to internet problems. And I was editing this on Hedgehog and wasn't able to finish everything. So your mileage may vary. I'm sorry for the contents. With that said, let's start. For those who don't know, HTTPSH is... maybe I shouldn't block the screen. HTTPSH is a web framework of my creation written in Bash. And... this means that like everything in there is written in Bash. It's not just everything from netcode to the APIs to everything else. And over the past 5 years, we've made it quite extensible. Mostly myself, but also where's Fanfo? Hi Fanfo, thank you Fanfo. Cheese for Fanfo. Let's set a rough stage for what we'll be talking about. There are three parts of the framework, and the first one is the core, so what actually handles the connections. The second one is the API, and this is what you use within your script to interface with the protocol and to create responses easier. And the third part is the rest of the OWL. So essentially what you write, we don't provide that. We have examples, but this is first and foremost a framework, not a ready-made thing. Let's start with the launcher. This is garbage. This is absolute garbage. I need to rewrite this. We will not be talking about what's going on here beyond NCAT being broken, then we needing to do a lot of workarounds. So there are a few things that may seem absolutely useless here. For instance, we're starting we're doing mktemp, then we're launching NCAT on the socket and socket binding to a TCP socket. Why is that? Well, this is a workaround for a bug that I think was in the Linux kernel. I wasn't able to actually find it, but it doesn't seem to be occurring anymore. The general issue was that if you were connecting to any NCAT-made socket, as in any NCAT-made TCP socket, then if you could transfer just a few bytes, everything would be all right. But if you went into the hundreds of kilobytes to megabytes range, then you would have a few bytes corrupted randomly. And I wasn't able to really debug why that was happening. Dumps made with Wireshark showed some TCP resets, like very, very spuriously. So that's probably what was happening, but I wasn't able to actually debug it. And for whatever reason, A, it didn't happen when the application was when you were connecting to HTTP locally, so over localhost, and it didn't happen when you had socket listening and passing it to NCAT. This is the only way to actually make it work. I think this got fixed, but this remains as a weird legacy thing we still have. But as I said, we're not gonna take much more time on this because this is pending a rewrite. Once you pass through the launcher itself, the connection flow is TCP to NCAT to socket, and the important distinction is after NCAT launches our handler for the connection, everything is over STDIO. So you echo to write to the TCP socket and you read to, well, read from it. And this is really useful because this allows us to very easily interface with the, well, with the protocol. First handler that gets launched is SRC server. This is the core. And the, well, what is the first thing that you would do with an HTTP request? You parse the headers, right? Because this is what the, what is in the header, what is in the connection first. You parse the method line and the headers. But there is a problem with that. See, not all connections are actually HTTP. Sometimes you will get some garbage. And the problem is that with a normal parser on this line, it will get stuck if it doesn't get an empty line, because this is what we use for the for delimiting between headers and body of the request. So the solution for this, I mean, there are two solutions that you could employ. First one is a timeout, but this is kind of lame, and it causes the connection to hang for like a minute or two anyways. The second option is much more ingenious. And this is to just pre-read a part of the first line and match whether it is one of the magic values. And why exactly 8 bytes? See, get and put are 3 bytes long, head and post are 4, patch is 5 bytes, and then we have delete and options. No, nothing is over 8 bytes. And through this, we can use this as a magic value, essentially. Now the question is, what if the initial line is shorter than 8 bytes? Not a problem. Essentially, this cannot ever happen in practice. You need to have at least 12 bytes if you omit the dot zero. Technically, you could send just get slash, but most HTTP implementations that I have tried handle this as a 400, so a bad request. So this is safe to do. Okay, going further. Vhosts, I assume that most of you are familiar with HTTP as a protocol, but to differentiate the request for where it is actually supposed to go, you have a header called host. And in normal HTTP servers, this gets matched through a directive like server underscore name. This is from Nginx. We are doing it in a little bit of a more interesting way. See, say we have a request for all telecom. Simply, we check whether there is a file called config/all telecom, and if it is, then we source it, and this is the config file, and you can do special casing in there. And yeah, this is quite useful for hosting multiple applications at one endpoint. And this really shows the roots of HTTP SSH as I have started this more as a server and less as a framework. Perhaps the biggest piece of code in the whole library is the templating engine. So we have implemented something like Jinja-like templating engine. I have never used Jinja. I just looked at it once, thought, oh yeah, that looks cool, and just kind of went with it. We will not be talking about all of this because this is frankly garbage. But there are a few really cool places in the code which we shall go through. Comments. Again?
Comments.
Why do you need comments? I know what's happening. I thought that I was the only person who knows what's happening, but Fanfu told me before the presentation that he actually understands it too, which is terrifying. I coded most of this in a train ride coming back home from an otaku convention in Poznań. And again?
No copy-paste anything else, or linearly written?
What do you mean? Most of this is written by hand, and I'm trying to make it as little code reuse as possible. Still, the insanity of this piece of code is I have written this in an overcrowded train coming back to Warsaw from Poznań, and I was literally sitting within the door. There was maybe 50 centimeters, maybe 30 centimeters of space. So it was really cramped with my laptop. It must have looked really funny. It took me like 2 hours, and I had a very, very basic version of it. I'm kind of proud of it because it grew into something that is actually quite useful for development. Maybe in the internals aren't as pretty, but we are actually working on it. So we will get back to this later. For now, let's get back to the cool places of it. To give you an idea, this is a mixed four-pass recursive regular templating engine, which essentially means that I kept adding stuff on top of it according to taste, and this has pros and cons, but generally it's stable, and we only had one vulnerability in it, so I'm really proud in a heck of a long time. This is a whole pipeline, and what results of that pipeline is a flat sed expression. So we are generating sed, and then we are executing sed once on the very end of the file. So the general layout is something like this. This is using only simple static tags. So each one of them will be replaced to a value that's predefined in the code. And it can be expressed like this. Like, this is, of course, not what I'm doing in the code, but if we were to oversimplify it, this is what is happening in there. And this is fine. This works okay, because every tag is only on one line. Now, if we want to have some more advanced options, such as the question mark is the if statement, then the problem is it starts on line 3 and ends on line, you know. Does any of you already, has anyone here already caught the problem with it? Exactly. The problem is that this will not work.
Kurwa blan.
The problem is, sed is a line editor, which means that it will only match an expression as long as it's contained on one line. What is the solution to this? Well, we can just remove new lines, substitute them with another character, and then use it as a line editor, and then when we're done, we substitute them back. So we are misusing sed as a stream editor. It's still the S still matches stream. Yes. Well, it's hex 01. We are assuming UTF-8. We are also trimming all hex 01s. This is kind of shit, but I have no clue how to make it prettier without like over-engineering the whole part. You have to remember, the whole templating engine is around 150 lines, maybe 200 by now. And we have conditionals, we have setting variables, we have, replacing the tags, we have iterators, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So the code is really compact. This is a trade-off that I'm willing to live with. And it has not posed a problem because, as I said, everyone is using UTF-8 instead of UTF-16. Second problem with the templating engine. As I said, we have iterators. So you can essentially do a for each on an array, and it will fill out a pretty table for you or whatever you want to use. And the problem is that Bash doesn't really have objects that can be nested, as in you have associative arrays, which are essentially arrays with... you can assign a name to each key of the array, so it's a key-value store. The problem is that you cannot really nest key-value stores in normal arrays, so you cannot do this kind of thing. And the solution is, well, let's make our own objects. We create a normal array. This is defined as a special thing purely because maybe in the future I will want to add some additional handling into it. Then we create another array to copy our contents into it. The epoch sequence random is to make sure that it is actually a unique name. Technically, like if I were to match the objects, it would be a little bit safer, but we are in the millions of combinations and it has not posed a problem yet. I doubt it will pose a problem. And the worst thing it can do is eat one object from the page. So, nah. This is how you would call it. So this is the internal API. This is the external API. You make a for loop and then you instead add each element. Now we have a. If you were an astute reader, might notice this part of the code, which is kind of bonkers. And this was initially written by May, which who is unfortunately not here. I thought that I should explain what this actually does. So there is a lot to unpack. Let's maybe show this in a terminal so everyone can understand. Actually, is it possible for someone to hold a microphone for me? Because I need hands to type. Thank you, JN. Hi. So let's say that we want to declare an array called meow and make four objects in it. Declare-p will show all of the objects that are in the array, and then let's say that our meow is equivalent to the arref in here. So if I do echo meow without anything, then it just echoes the zeroth object. If I do echo with the at sign, then it echoes all objects. And then if I add an A, it essentially does the same thing as declare-p, but it doesn't use a subshell for it. So you save some time on, entering a new context. Further on, you can notice that we have the colon here. And this is an insane hack that not many people know about, but if you do colon and, for instance, echo meow, and then do echo dollar underscore, then you get the output from this command. This is a temporary variable without setting a variable. This is really cool for, making things that you don't need to keep track of for longer. And we are using exactly that here. So what is happening is, one more thing. We also use... we use capital A, we use lowercase a. Lowercase a, hold on. Lowercase a shows an a, and this a comes from here. So it shows how to declare the object, what options were used for it. So essentially what we end up doing is we declare dash g, which is global, and then we copy all of the options that were used on the original array. Then we create a new array with for our temporary purposes. And we fill that array with the temporary value. Hash is stripped from the beginning. So we strip until the first equal sign. What this does, let me show you. I want this one. What this does, underscore hash star equals, is hold on. Okay, what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to strip the variable name and only leave the contents. I'm messing it up somehow, but generally, yeah, that's how this works. And it's kind of insane how much meaning can you fit into two lines of hash. I also kind of hate it. But thank you, May, for writing this pretty concoction. Before that, we were using an array. The reason not to use an array here is because it's slower. Moving on. Also, the template engine, we have pseudotypes. I have touched this on this briefly before. So every object can be prefixed with a type. Hash is include, dot is the standard type, at is a row, and you have this special start for iterators and conditionals. Further on, this is how you actually interface with it in the code. So you prefill an associative array with the names of the tags, and the names are one-to-one from the template, except for standard tags which omit the dot. Okay, now, since we talk about include state, the include statement, it's a little bit problematic to implement because, as I said, we are using the set we are generating the set expression on the fly and only executing it as the last thing. But the include warrants that we actually consider statements inside the included thing, because without it, we would be just including a text file, and we want to include a template file. The solution for this is truly deranged, and there were multiple things that I could have done. I think this is the worst one, and I absolutely love it. So essentially, we read all of the template files into a variable called garbage, and then we, instead of parsing the normal file of ours, we parse the file called garbage for all of the tags that require this treatment. So for iterators and everything else. This way, if an iterator needs to extract the value from an include array, it can just do it, and it actually doesn't matter whether the included template will be in the correct place in the file, it just needs to be somewhere. So, yeah, we are using the garbage file.
Oh, it's not Packard.
Correct. even more templates. I promise we're finishing with them, but this is really cool. So I initially wrote this as a very simple thing that was supposed to work for like one page and never be used again. It got used again a lot. And with Project Surfail, which is our authoritative DNS project that includes a web page written in HTTPSH for managing the records, we needed a way to theme the page itself because we wanted it to be nice and we wanted the users to enjoy using it. So we could have done that entirely in HTTP, entirely in Surfail web, so downstream, but it's better to implement this upstream. And the approach I took was, this is the standard way to render a template. So it has been reduced a little bit with the new calling method. And the approach I took was, on every render call, we try to find an include a template file in a predefined list of directories that can contain templates. And this is a hierarchical list, which means that you can have preferences for which the theme to actually use. So this is neat, because we can have a directory with multiple themes, and then we define a hierarchy of what themes we actually want to use in this rendering. Then the main theme contains a lot of garbage, but the alternative theme can contain as little as one file because we just want to override that one file and that's it. So this is really neat because theme management is usually a lot of pain and a lot of time wasted for the maintainers. Here we are circumventing a part of it for the simpler themes, and we are also using ensuring that even if a theme is unmaintained, you will drop back to the default theme. So the app is never gonna be without a functionality. One of the last things that I want to talk about is NotAutom. This is our generic storage API, and right now it's using a CSV-like approach where we store keys and we store values into a binary file, and then we can read them later. In the end, I would like this to be a generic API for databases like SQLite and Postgres. So we can use one API and do calls of multiple databases. But the interesting part that we already have is the selectors. So you might have noticed that the call includes the call itself, then the file name, then the selector, and a callback. In this case, the other calls are different. And let's look at the selector logic. So you have an opening and closing brace. This is an empty selector. You can also write a name of a field in there. This will match the zero field in a table. You can change which field gets matched. You can chain multiple selectors. And the only real requirement for the only real limitation is that you need to maintain the white space, because we are parsing each one of those. You will see in a second. So this is one of the NotAutom functions, and the cool part really starts on this line. You might wonder how we actually manage to parse the because we have multiple functions, right? And the selector parsing logic is quite long, and I wouldn't want to rewrite it for every function. So of course we call data parse parse, which itself is quite simple and just uses shift for getting the correct parameter into place, and then fills two arrays with data that we later use to generate an expression. Does anyone already see a problem with this? Because we have a function, then we call another presumably function, and then we use shift in this nested function, which has no parameters. So for people who don't know, deny presentation break. For people who don't know, shift is something that switches the positional parameters into either one place right or one place left. So $1 will result to a different thing. And this cannot be used on, this can only be used in the current context, or in the current function. If we switch further, if we call another function and then use shift on it, nothing will happen because we didn't give any parameters in there. So the solution is, this is actually not a function, this is an alias. And aliases in Bash are very similar to functions, except not at all. So a function can have parameters, and the parameters will actually append it to the stack. So we have $1, $2, and so on. And this creates another context. With regards to an alias, instead, you don't have another context. You create a Bash inserts this as is into the structure. So essentially, we are still in the main function, and the only thing we needed to do is alias and quote everything. And actually, if we were to provide parameters to this, they wouldn't be added onto the stack. They would be added to the very end of the call. So they would be absolutely useless for us. And the obvious question is, why wouldn't this be a function? We can just pass all the parameters. The biggest problem is that we may run into white space splitting issues. But the other problems are, it's harder to pass the data, and it's harder to get the initial function into a state where we can read the rest of the positional parameters. Let's talk a little bit about performance. We have a bunch of components that are quite slow and we are working on it. The templating engine is unsurprisingly one of the worst things of the bunch. Nested arrays used to be really bad. They are a little bit better now because right now we are using the random approach. And before we generated the random IDs based on defrandom, which is slower because you need to open a file. A runner up for the Shame Award is not ORM because it's quite slow, but it's doing a lot of work. And it's actually really hard to optimize it because it's data. Handling a lot of data is hard. The biggest improvement in the template engine part was when we moved away from all temporary files onto temporary variables. And this was really hard to do. But it boils down to a really short diff that improved our performance by like 150 milliseconds on the benchmark. Which is quite nice. This literally just tries to eliminate as much of file I/O as possible. The nested arrays, as I said, removed the calls to defurandom. So now we're using the internal entropy source. It kind of sucks, but I already explained why this sucks. We may need to look into an alternative later. This was actually a quite major change. Also, what changed was, as I said, we used the declare-p earlier. This is much much slower. Also, we used eval. Eval is evil. Don't use eval ever, because essentially you can get RCE without knowing that you got RCE. And this, under very specific circumstances, could have been exploited. And you wouldn't see it, because this does... This is essentially the same thing as here, but the eval means that we, in some cases, can mess with the escaping of special characters and make it do unintended things. What if we wanted to go even faster? The Bash includes a not very well-known API called the loadable built-in modules. This is quite confusing. What it does is you have a shared library file, and that defines a table of functions. You can call the functions, and generally the examples are in C, terribly under-documented, and we had problems with actually getting some of them to run. The obvious solution for this is to write a common Rust FFI for writing Bash modules. And Jayan, if you could come once again, I need to demonstrate. Thank you. If we go to projects Rust Bash modules examples, essentially, all you need to... Wow, this is a terrible example. I should go into hello. Okay, all you need to do is define a macro with a built-in, and our library does everything else. And essentially, how you call this is... You have a file called run.sh. This is an example. This is actually wrong. And it's really funny. We discovered yesterday that our modules randomly stopped working. We weren't sure why that was. And FAMFO spent a major part of this morning trying to bisect what broke in Bash, and we're still not sure. But if we do help enable, it turns out that -n is disable each name instead of specify the name. So we're not sure how this even worked ever, but we're going to roll with it and just remove the N. And now we have a new command called hello. And as an example, it will call the Rust printf for us and print the context provided on the argv. This can be extended much further. One of our other examples is for the ASOC arrays and normal arrays. So you can actually interact with the state and you can create new arrays. You can interact with the code as a first class citizen. This is still work in progress, but generally it's possible to go much, much faster with it. And we have a work in progress rewrite of the template engine in Rust, which is actually, if I can find it, Serfe Web Rust SRC. So if you remember how I said that the normal template engine is like 200 lines, maybe. This is 3/4 of a template engine in Rust, and it's already 202, so it will be 500 lines at the very least. But I suppose that this is some code that is a little bit easier to read. Functionally, it's equivalent to everything I've already shown you, so there's not much point in explaining it. Yeah, so this is essentially everything from me. The question is, how much time do I have left, if any? Okay, sorry. Then no examples. Thanks for talking. Thanks for listening, and yeah, thank you.